This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Clean water is one of those things that you don't really think about until you no longer have it. And it's vital that human beings have access to clean water. That's why state agencies like the Department of Health and the Department of Environmental Protection exist, to test our groundwater and drinking water and make sure we aren't being poisoned by it. But three recent reports have shown that within 50-mile radius in southwest Florida, there are three communities with contamination issues that residents feel are not being addressed. Scott Wilkinson lives in Bukelia on the north end of Pine Island, where WGCU's Jessica Mazzaros first reported back in May about possibly misread arsenic readings that went ignored for years. Those readings showed levels thousands of times higher than the allowable limits. And Wilkinson says when he read that the county and state closed the original wells and stopped testing for arsenic around 2015, he was outraged.
Even if it's only 141 micrograms per liter instead of 141,000, that's still very high. But they thought at the time it was 141,000. That's almost sludge. And they just, rather than looking and calling into question the results, which, you know, would probably be an illogical thing to do, they didn't even do that. They just stopped testing. And we could very well have a hazardous waste site out on Flatwoods Preserve.
Wilkinson says he wants government officials to find out where this arsenic came from for the people of Pine Island.
It's going to cost money to fix this problem or find out that we don't have a problem, either one. But the longer they put it off, if there's contamination there, the more it's going to spread.
Those concerns are echoed in the Dunbar neighborhood in Fort Myers, where residents have long suspected that one city block in the middle of their community was tainted, even after the dumping of toxic lime sludge ended there years ago. And then there's Charleston Park in East Lee County, where tap water comes from a tainted well, and the nearest place to buy bottled water is miles away. The three reporters who discovered these stories are here in the studio with me now. Jessica Mazzaros with WGCU, who uncovered the Pine Island arsenic story. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Patricia Bournes with the News Press is also with us. She first brought the Dunbar neighborhood's toxic sludge story to light earlier this year. Patricia, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Julie.
And also Janine Zeitlin is here. She's with the News Press as well. And she brought us the Charleston Park story of tainted water. Thanks for your time today, Janine.
Thanks for having me.
We are talking about turning on the tap and not being able to trust that the water coming out of it is safe. Being suspicious of the groundwater near your neighborhood and wondering what state officials are doing about it. You can join this conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. We invited county, city, and state officials to join the conversation today, but all declined to come on the air with us, and we had a hard time getting a hold of the city officials. We were able to exchange some emails and get measured responses to a few questions, and we'll share those responses as they come up. So first, let me begin by getting the latest on the Dunbar toxic waste area. Patricia Bournes, how did you first hear about this story?
I first heard about it from the City of Fort Myers Real Estate Department. They have a lot of lots in Dunbar that are cheap that they give to affordable housing projects. And this block, this city block in the middle of a residential neighborhood was one of them. And I was told, unfortunately, it's contaminated. And that got me curious. I went out to look at it. A planner source, a former planner for our outlet, then told me that the city had contaminated it. And I went to Department of Environmental Protection records and found that, you know, indeed, it was the groundwater was being monitored and had been since 2007 or so, 8, yeah.
So the people that live there kind of knew about this?
No, they didn't. They had no idea.
Hearsay?
There was hearsay about what was this soil, because the contamination was coming from this lime sludge that the city had dumped there as a byproduct of its water treatment process. And they wondered about what that stuff was. It was gooey, and generations of children played in it. And I think that there was a concern that in heavy rains and that would run across, you know, the runoff. There were wells at the time at some point that people were drinking out of. And, yeah, there was a concern, but nobody knew.
It was just kind of like, oh, there's something going on there, but we're not really sure what it is.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And so then you took the time to go find those documents and figure out what exactly had happened.
Yes, yes. And I also got city public records that showed when the city purchased the property. I found records that showed that they attempted to sell the whole block to Habitat for Humanity. Habitat did an assessment and made them buy it back in 1994. They attempted to do an assessment to alleviate themselves of any cleanup obligations under Superfund, an assessment that basically said there's no sludge here when they knew there was.
So when they first started doing this dumping there, was there a neighborhood there? Or was it – I mean, the way we look at it now, there's a full neighborhood around this block.
Right.
Was it always like that, or was it kind of a vacant area when they first started?
People will say that there was very little there, but there were residents there. And more importantly, this entire area had been platted by Lee County for residences. It had not been filled in. And Lee County sold it to the city at the time. This was not the city of Fort Myers. It filled in much more so in the later 1960s and in the 1970s, and dumping was continuing at that time.
They continued to dump even though the neighborhood was –
it was
filling with people.
Yes.
When did they stop dumping toxic waste there?
Now, I'm trying to figure that out. The aerials suggest that maybe it was in the 1980s. I've heard, you know, the city switched over its water treatment process in about 1994. And I'm not sure from the aerials that they continued dumping then. I do know they also dumped at their own well field in the early 1990s.
So when you're talking with the neighborhood residents out there, do they say that they saw people dumping back in the – because the 80s is recent. There would be people who live there who may have seen it.
I've spoken to one resident, Ricky Rogers. He was one of the first people I ever talked to who grew up there and actually saw the original dumping. Remembers it being filled in. It was sort of like two ponds, and he remembers the sludge being dumped.
One of the people that you talked with is Lutricia Becker. She lives in Dunbar, and here's what she had to say about the toxic lime sludge in her neighborhood.
It's tossed waste over there, and it's in a high level. Come on, we are human over here. We are peoples. You know, I think they need to test it out. I don't care. To me, it need to be tested from house to house. My main thing is that the people just not being honest with us. You know, I don't like that about the city.
Is that kind of the consensus? Do people that you're talking with seem to feel like they're not being told the truth?
I would say so. You know, I think that upon learning that the city had been testing this and finding arsenic for over 10 years – didn't do a lot for people's trust.
And they've only been testing that particular vacant lot?
Yes. They never tested off-site. They've done the first off-site tests very recently, and they installed some monitoring wells. But they installed them upstream, you know, which basically is a cover for them to see if something else could have polluted the site instead of them. You know, if you really want to test off-site to see if this is going into the residents, you know, if it's going into the groundwater on resident properties, perhaps you would test all around. You know, you wouldn't necessarily just test upstream.
Mm-hmm. We asked the Department of Environmental Protection to come on the show today, but they declined and invited us to email them questions, which I did. One of the questions was, ultimately, who is responsible for testing a site and cleaning it up? I also asked her what happens when you initially hear that there's a question about pollution in a certain area. And Deanne Miller, she's with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. She sent a long email back, which contained the following excerpt. When the department receives a complaint, we start with research and sometimes on-site inspections. This includes following up with the complaint for any missing details regarding what triggered the complaint. Was it a test result, a spill, historic use, alleged dumping, etc., to give us an idea of what type of pollution may exist, in what form, and how long it may have been there. We also work to identify the responsible party, which is often the landowner. And in this situation, Patricia, what you seem to have found is the responsible party is kind of
– the city of Fort Myers.
I mean, mm-hmm. That has to be determined, but I mean, they're the owner of it. And how many crossing of T's and dotting of I's have to happen for that to – be found by the DEP? Have they gotten to the point of making that determination?
I felt that from the documents that I read, they certainly had made that determination in 2006 and 2007. You know, and the city itself, you know, by attempting to sell the land, I think is saying that they own it. I think there's no question that they own it. And there's no question that they bought the land to dump there and that they did dump there. Those things aren't disputed. I think that there's a last-ditch effort maybe to see if the arsenic came from somewhere else, you know, in the neighborhood onto the site rather than from the sludge, which has been tested in 2007, I believe. It exceeds all residential standards for arsenic, you know, in the sludge. But, you know.
So right now we're in the last-ditch effort part.
I think that we're in a testing phase. I do think that, you know, the city is now, you know, lawsuits. The city has been noticed for two lawsuits. There's now people are being encouraged also to file civil rights claims, and the city has hired counsel most recently. So, yes, I think the city is making some efforts to minimize or point the polluter finger elsewhere, probably.
So most recently there was a meeting, I think it was last week, I believe it was, and they decided to allocate funds towards hiring legal counsel. And right. Have you talked with any of the residents of the neighborhood since then to find out how they feel about the money, $150,000, I believe, being spent on legal counsel rather than testing, waste removal, I mean, cleanup? Things like that?
Sure. There is a sense of, you know, outrage. I think as one woman said, you know, you're using our tax dollars to sue us. You've got it all backwards. And I think that's the kind of feeling. You know, look, you dumped it. Clean it up. What are you doing spending this money? The city has also just, you know, made, you know, they're looking for money to spend, more money to spend on a downtown hotel. You know, people are understandably a little outraged about that. But I did speak to one resident who understood, well, you know, we're possibly suing them. They have to defend themselves. So
Deanne Miller from the DEP also sent us a link to the Department of Environmental Protection's online contamination locator map, which shows hundreds of contaminated sites in Lee County and their status in terms of cleanup or mitigation. We were surprised to not find a block in the Dunmar neighborhood listed on that map. Do you know why they wouldn't have that listed?
It is actually listed under something called inactive sites. I thought that they had activated it again, actually.
Well, as of this morning, there was not a little triangle on there indicating that that was a site. So okay, we were looking at it. We couldn't believe it wasn't there. And if anybody would like to see for themselves, we do have a link to that interactive map on our website at wgcunews.org if you want to take a look at it and see what's near your neighborhood or anything. Of course, you know, I immediately looked right at my own neighborhood in that area just to see because you just kind of want to know. A lot of the things that I was seeing was underground tanks and, like, you know, gas stations. But this Dunbar neighborhood was not there.
Exactly. Yes. And I did find it. At first, I didn't find it either. Then I found a place on the website for inactive sites, and it was there listed as inactive. You know, it's not a brownfield. It's not a Superfund site. But I agree with you. You know, it's active now, and I believe you know, the city is going through a full site assessment, and it should be on there.
So next is going to come the eventual cleanup, and as far as who has to do that, I'm going to go back to that email from Deanne Miller with the Florida DEP. She says that it's the responsibility of the responsible party to conduct any necessary sampling and to clean up if the contamination has migrated offsite. While we're waiting for that to happen, what's happening in Dunbar to ensure that the contamination of the land there isn't affecting people that live around it?
Well, the testing, the assessment that they're doing is the scientific effort to see if it's affecting people. By placing off-site wells around, you try to identify whether there's a plume, for example, of arsenic that may be running off-site. But this is a complicated situation because this site goes back 55 years when people were drinking out of shallow wells. And ultimately, this assessment will probably be handed to something called a toxicologist, someone who makes a determination about this information, this contamination, and what its present danger is, its future danger, and its past danger. You know,
people living there now, though, are not living on well water.
Most of them aren't. Some people can't afford to connect to the city service or the county service in this case, and are still on wells. Not too many, but some.
Wow. So next up is they continue doing this testing for how long?
The testing should wrap up pretty soon. In fact, I think they've finished conducting the test and they're waiting for what the city calls certified results. Some of the results will be in soon, like this week, I think. Mm-hmm. But the city isn't releasing them until they're quote, certified, which means the lab manager signs off on them.
And we're looking at January for that?
Yes. The city plans to have a meeting in mid-January to address the public and residents about the results, and which, meanwhile, I'm sure they'll share with their attorney.
Well, they paid him. So All right. So we are talking about three different investigations into water quality issues in Lee County with the reporters who covered those stories. You can join our conversation as well by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now let's turn to Charleston Park out in Alva, where News Press reporter Janine Zeitlin found that tainted well water in a relatively isolated little community has led to murky water with people unable to truck in clean water. Janine, I know we talked about this community recently here on the show, but could you give our listeners a quick summary in case they hadn't heard your reporting before?
Sure, absolutely. So this community is fairly rural, and for the past, at least since the 90s, they've been voicing concerns about bad water out there in terms of drinking water and not being able to drink the water that comes from their wells.
So they noticed it themselves?
Yes.
And were trying to bring it to people's attention, and what happened then?
Back in the 90s, they brought it to the county, and the county looked into some solutions, which included connecting that particular community to a utility that's that would be closer inland, or there's also a small water system that serves private migrant housing. So there was talk about connecting people, because they're all in private wells out there, to a utility that and once you are connected to a utility, there's a little – there are much more rigorous standards in terms of drinking water. So you have someone who's basically checking your water quality, whereas with private wells, it's pretty much up to you.
It's kind of anything goes.
Free for all.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about Charleston Park? Tell me about this community. How did it come to be? It's kind of – you said rural. It doesn't have a whole lot around it. There aren't a lot of stores.
It has an interesting history. From what I understand, I spoke with someone from Alva who back in the 20s when they were building orange groves, they brought in black farm workers and to help with the orange groves. And his understanding was that people were just camping out in Alva area, and there were complaints because of the skin color of the workers. And so a group of farmers got together and bought land that could then be resold at a very affordable price to these black farm workers. And pretty much it's you know, largely still African American. It's about 80%.
Kind of like an early kind of co-op, like a real estate co-op thing. And then so these people were living there. And then how has that community grown since then?
I wouldn't say it's grown necessarily.
How has it evolved?
It's evolved. Well, now they have – there's actually some pretty there's private migrant housing there now. And so, you know, at the beginning – they were just shacks, and people had outhouses and trailers. Zoning changed over the years that barred people from having trailers. So now you have some concrete homes, you have some nice manufactured homes, and then you have private migrant housing that it's fairly segregated because a company owns that housing. So, and that's primarily Hispanic workers who live there.
And who lives there now? Who lives in Charleston Park overall? Is it an older community? Is it a younger community?
I would say, you know, you have a lot of seniors there, but you also have a lot of young people. You have extended families, so people living with grandparents and working class people, bus drivers.
Mm-hmm. So as for what the water actually looks like, I'd like us to hear from Charleston Park resident Raven Adams.
Sometimes when we first turn it on, it'd be so yellow and brownish. You know, you could tell it's got so much polluted toxin in it. And when it look like that, we'll either, like, you know, wash our face, brush our teeth with the water that we buy for ourselves. I don't have no vehicle, so I at least travel like probably like 10 to 15 minutes away from my house just to go get some water. And it's like $20 just to go. Just them to pick us up is 10. Just them take us and bring us back is 20. Like, I have like dry spots. My baby had dry spots. LaBelle doctor told me that if it's not my hormones, it must be the water.
She's talking about dry spots on her skin?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, what are we talking about here?
Like rashes. People have reoccurring rashes. Their skin gets irritated because there's essentially two issues going on out there based upon past testing. And one is bacteriological contamination in the shallow wells. And the other is in the deeper aquifer, where deeper wells would pull, where the newer wells would pull, is you have extreme amounts of saline water. So that would probably be causing, I mean, if the dry patches.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Salt water.
Yes.
So I asked the county for comment, and the public information officer there, Betsy Clayton, responded via email. She couldn't be on the show either. The Department of Health is in charge of drinking water testing and standards. DOH is taking the lead in Charleston Park. The county is assisting via its Human Services Department, which has staff that works with the resident coordinator and the community center. So then I reached out to the Department of Health, and they declined to come on the show, but they welcomed us to send questions. I did send a list of questions, and I did not get a response to that email. Have you had any luck getting any information from the Department of Health about its responsibilities as pertains to people drinking contaminated well water?
No. I know that they are – the sampling is ongoing, but I've asked for – since last week I've been asking for details in terms of when they're out there, how many homes they're testing, the process of testing, and they have not responded to those questions as of yet.
So these people have been asking about this since the 90s, the early 90s you said.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 2017, and the Department of Health is currently – running tests on the water.
Yes.
And that's as far as we've gotten?
Yes. They are running, from my understanding of my last communication with Department of Health, they're testing for bacteria and nitrates, which those would be the contaminants that would be more prone to be found in the shallow wells. But I have yet to hear how our governmental agencies are looking into the aquifer issues, because they have data that shows that there are issues with the aquifer, as well as, you know, we did our own sampling and we found the same issues.
So the solutions that you mentioned earlier are hooking onto the county water supply or having a water filtration system that's able to handle all the numerous residents there, or just installing individual filters on individual homes. Those are the three different possibilities.
Yeah, and in terms of the each home, like the ideal solution might be drilling a deeper well, because then it's less prone to bacteriological contamination, and then getting the RO system on there and the filter. But there's an effort going on in Charleston Park now called Clean Water for Charleston Park, and it's an initiative by Blankets and Blessings, which is a nonprofit outreach group. And you know, their solution is an RO and the filter system, which
RO being reverse osmosis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that gets rid of the salinity?
That would deal with, yes. Mm-hmm. So drinkable. So they have it on the faucet, so they could, it would be drinkable.
Okay. So as a result of your reporting, this is a nonprofit that stepped up mm-hmm. to try to create a solution to this.
Yes.
But we haven't heard anything in the way of solutions from any of the governmental agencies that could be overseeing this.
I think their solution right now is doing the sampling. But in terms of the overall solution, I think it's because it's a complicated issue, no one is really stepping up and saying, yes, we're going to resolve this, at least in terms of a governmental agency.
Yeah, well, once you say that you're going to resolve it, it's going to cost money to do it. You know, what is the cost? Do you know yet what the cost is of hooking up to the county water?
Well, back in the 90s, it was more than $1 million. So.
And then a giant filter to handle the entire neighborhood?
Well, that would be connecting like an actual line. So they'd build a line from wherever, I think it was Olga Utility they were looking at the time. Uh-huh. And then connecting each person then would be responsible for connecting to that.
Well, so, and that would be probably cost prohibitive. I mean, there are people in Dunbar, we just heard from Patricia, that aren't hooking on to the city utilities.
Exactly.
Because they can't afford to hook on.
Exactly, exactly. So to some degree, it's an issue of cost, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, individual and municipal,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So what is the water situation there right now?
Right now, my understanding from residents is that the health department has started sampling homes, and I know the folks with Clean Water for Charleston Park and Blankets and Blessings were out there last night meeting with residents at a community meeting and talking. They want to meet residents where they're at, and they've just installed their first RO system to a family there, and they plan to just do that one by one.
Have the residents kind of felt like they're being listened to finally, or have they kind of resigned themselves to, you know, nobody's going to do anything?
Well, I think now there's some excitement out there. Some momentum, and so they're responding to people responding to their needs. But I would say when I was reporting this, they were just kind of like there was definitely a feeling of this isn't ever going to get resolved. We just have to live with it.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with three reporters who this year have uncovered some serious water issues that are plaguing concentrations of people in Charleston Park and Dunbar neighborhoods, as well as on Pine Island. You can become part of this conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I'm going to turn now to a WGCU investigation by Jessica Mazaros of arsenic levels on Pine Island. Initially, Jessica, you unearthed reports that were submitted to the state by the county, which showed alarmingly high levels of arsenic. How did you uncover that?
So this came out during a public meeting for Lee County's Conservation 2020 Committee. Greg Rawl, who's on the committee, was alarmed during some regular business. They were talking about Pine Island Flatwoods Preserve, which is in St. James City at the southern tip of Pine Island. And he was surprised to find that Pine Island Wastewater Treatment Plant had a permit through the state to spray its wastewater onto that conservation land. And so this concerned Greg, and he decided to look deeper into it and uncovered some documents that showed really high arsenic levels. He was at first concerned about nutrients and then found really high arsenic levels. And then we realized that there was a year missing. And I actually went to the DEP office and asked, you know, why isn't this in Oculus? Is their website where you can find documents? And why is this year missing, which was 2013, November of 2013? Come to find, it showed 141,000 micrograms of arsenic per liter, and it's not supposed to surpass 10. Since then, since the first initial investigation came out in May, the county has resubmitted its numbers to the state saying, those numbers were incorrect. And basically, the new numbers are moving the decimal place over to the left three times. And so now it's 104. Back in 2013 was 141 micrograms per liter. That still exceeds the federal Environmental Protection Agency's allowance of arsenic in drinking water by 14 times. But I think that the initial investigation, it was really just highlighting that whether or not these numbers, which they were outstanding numbers, whether or not they were correct or not, it was submitted by the county, signed off by a county official, and stamped with the DEP stamp on it. And then it continued for years with these high levels. And it didn't seem to raise any red flags in that sense. It just kept being submitted and no efforts to remove it or figure out whether or not these numbers. They wanted to look into whether or not these numbers were correct after my investigation came out, which was years later after these numbers were first submitted.
Yeah, 2017. So they had these numbers that were going in that they have said, oh, we just missed a decimal point, which is kind of a big deal when you're talking
three
about
three decimal points, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Three is. So that, but the thing is, the county did that. They sent it on to the state, and the state didn't raise an eyebrow.
Well, I'm not. There's no documents to support that it did. However, the county, I guess, was alarmed, or they decided in 2014 to adjust their permit with the state regarding this wastewater treatment or regarding this land. And as part of that, they hired an outside consultant. And as part of the consultant's suggestions was, this level of arsenic is high, but it has something to do with cattle grazing operations. This well is corroded. Let's close this well. And so in 2015, the state actually signed off on the county to close the wells, and then they decided to stop testing for arsenic after that. That's as far as we knew in that time.
So the state is getting arsenic levels that are alarmingly high, like just astronomical pretty much. I mean, it seems like it's...
Seems like it, yes. The numbers were submitted as 14,000 times higher than what's allowed by the federal government.
So the state gets a thing from the county. They're saying, hey, we want to make some changes. And then they say, oh, yeah, hey. The state says, go ahead and close down that.
Well, they hired the outside consultant. The outside consultant said these numbers are high, but again, went back and said, but the consultant was using the numbers. I guess there was a confusion as to who was submitting what, because the outside consultant said it was 141 micrograms, according to his documents. But the documents that the county was sending to the state was 141,000.
So he saw the decimal misplacement.
And so he was using those numbers. So he said, it's 14 times over the federal limit, but it's based on cattle grazing, cattle grazing operations, which we also, WGCU debunked, or looked into, how that would be possible.
Cattle grazing. I don't think did cattle make arsenic.
So no, there's a few things here. The first thing is cattle have been grazing on Pine Island Flatwoods Preserve since the early 2000s, and the spike in arsenic came in 2012. So I'm not sure how 12 years later we'd see arsenic in these such high numbers. And then the other thing is that there are things called cattle dipping vats, and that the last known cattle dipping vat somewhere on Pine Island was in 1933, and this is how they basically dig a big hole in the ground, fill it with arsenic, and they dip these cattle in there to get rid of bugs that are on them, ticks, things like that. And so that was a process that was closed down in the early 1900s. But it's unclear how cattle in this particular place would have anything to do with Pine Island Flatwoods Preserve. At the same time, what we're not talking about right now is 2 miles away is a residential area called Island Acres Estate, and they also had a wastewater from Pine Island wastewater treatment plant sprayed there, and so they were also being monitored, and there was a spike in arsenic on that land as well at the same time. The same years that there was a spike in Pine Island Flat was preserved, 2 miles away, there was also a spike noted in Island Acres Estate, a private neighborhood. So there's no cattle grazing there that we know of. So if it was going to be cattle, that doesn't explain why there's also arsenic being detected 2 miles away.
So spraying wastewater, is that something that then would cause arsenic to spike?
The wastewater numbers that come out don't. So they actually do test at the wastewater treatment plant the water before it goes out. They test that once a year. And it doesn't show that it does show a little bit of an exceedance that year. It was 12 micrograms per liter, but that's not significantly high. There is nothing to indicate that it's coming from the wastewater. It's just that these two wells that are being monitored based on the wastewater happen to be spiking with arsenic, but there's nothing to show that it's coming from the wastewater, particularly based on these tests. So
we keep talking about arsenic, and I don't know. Any three of the people in the room here could probably answer this one. What's the deal with arsenic? Well, I mean, is it terrible? I mean, I'm not thinking it sounds palatable or something that I would like to consume a lot of, but how bad is it?
Do anyone want to take that?
All right. We'll all take it. I'll say this. The old EPA standard used to be 50 parts per billion. You know, the effects on human health were such that in the early 2000s, I think, it was changed to 10. Mm-hmm. It is a concern for human health. And it's not just ingesting a high level, although that can certainly make you very, very ill. It's the lower long-period exposure. More and more we're learning. I just looked at a study that was looking at pancreatic cancer, you know, from long-term exposure to low doses, you know, above 10 parts per million to arsenic. And Jeanine, I'm sure you've looked into this a lot too.
Yeah.
Well, I also a resident of Pine Island gave me a call who we heard from earlier, Scott Wilkinson, and he was sharing with me that why this particularly bothered him about when he read my investigation and he looked at the story was because he says he can't prove it, but when he lived in New Hampshire, he drank out of a well, and in New Hampshire there's granite, and that tends to put arsenic in the water.
It leaches arsenic into water.
Right, and he had it tested 3 times, and he says that it came out high levels of arsenic, and he was drinking it for 8 years, and he had a lot of stomach issues. So he was particularly concerned about Pine Island because he lives there now. As we heard earlier, he lives on Vokelia, not in St. James City. He lives in the northern end, but he's still very concerned, and he says that he's experienced this himself. Uh-huh. Some arsenic poisoning, he says.
Yeah, we heard from him earlier in the show, and he reports that he was drinking water for probably about 8 years, and then he found out that he had some problems with his stomach and his colon, and he blamed the arsenic. He can't really prove it. It's kind of something hard to prove. Patricia, I mean, you're nodding your head, right?
Yes, it is. There are a lot of residents now who are really afraid and don't know much about this arsenic and are afraid that they have a number of health problems and you know, anything from cancers. There's a very high rate of cancer in the neighborhood.
In the Dunbar neighborhood?
Yes, and asthma, skin issues, you know, a number of health issues. People don't know if it's related to that site. You know, there are people who probably, maybe it's not, they haven't been there that long, they didn't play in it, but there are people who've been there for generations who could possibly have an effect.
The problem with trying to prove health effects of a given site is that it seems to always be anecdotal. And are you seeing anybody doing any kind of study door-to-door to see if anybody's been impacted?
The University of Miami Environmental Justice Clinic, those students have been out and continue to canvas people to learn, people who lived there in the past and currently to get their health histories and then their medical records. One concerning thing that I've heard is this call to do medical testing and arsenic testing with people, which sounds good. But an arsenic test, you know, is just a – you know, it tests your short-term exposure to arsenic, 6 months maybe at the most. Mm-hmm. And that has nothing to do with looking for a connection with illnesses that developed over a period of time.
So with long-term exposure.
Exactly. Right. I think that the University of Miami students are trying to work on this. It's a very, very difficult thing to connect.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I want to ask a wrap-up question for all three of you. We tried our best to get representatives from the county and state to join today's conversation, and they all declined. We had difficulty getting a hold of the city. Can you reflect a little for me on the challenge of getting officials to go on record about issues like these contaminated sites? Janine, I'm going to point to you first. I haven't heard from you in a while.
Sure. That's a hard one. You know, I think there's a lack of knowledge in general about, you know, in terms of aquifer issues. People within the Natural Resources Department are aware of the aquifer, but the aquifer, it's complicated. And so people don't always, they might look for the first suspect versus looking deeper into why, you know, for in Charleston Park, why the water is bad versus looking for the most obvious suspect, which it might be the most obvious suspect, but it also involves these deeper issues. It involves time and investing into people's – actually looking into people's concerns.
But as a reporter, how responsive were officials? Was it – could you track them down? Was it, or did you have to really work hard to get some answers out of people?
Well, it's been harder since the first package of stories, I would say. You know, earlier, before the first package of stories, it was easier to get people to talk. But now it's difficult.
Patricia, how has it been for you getting officials to communicate with you about what's happening in Dunbar?
I would say it's similar. You know, once the story breaks, and if it's not good news, you know, it can be extremely difficult. I was especially disappointed that the council members for City of Fort Myers who represent these minority communities and the one who represents this community in particular have just been, you know, missing in action completely on this. Very disappointed in that. You know, there's now a current, you know, effort to, you know, basically they're inaccessible, I would say, at this point. Now you have to understand that they're in a difficult situation because they've been noticed, you know, of intent to file a couple of suits. So
yeah,
there's that.
Jessica, did you have a hard time getting people to communicate with you?
Before I get to your question, I just thought it was important for me to mention, since we're talking about drinking water and arsenic, I thought it was important for people on Pine Island to know that there's no indication right now that shows this high arsenic levels on Pine Island Flatwoods Preserve is affecting people's drinking water.
Yeah, this is
because
groundwater.
It's shallow groundwater, and that we know of right now, and some experts, some hydrogeologists I've talked to have mentioned this is not, that we know of right now, an issue for drinking water. I just wanted people to know that and not
don't
panic
out
about that. Mm-hmm. And to go back to your question, it was really interesting. I mean, it's kind of just the same experience you had to try to get these officials on the show. It's mostly emailing back and forth and sometimes skipping over questions, like direct questions. For instance, when I was surprised that the wells were closed and the testing stopped for arsenic. And I was like, why did this happen? Why did this happen with these levels so high? Whether or not they were correct or not, they were being submitted in this way to you, to the state. And back then in May, spokesperson Deanne Miller had said that the monitoring well on Pineland Flatwoods Preserve was no longer a good source for testing, which led to the well's closure in 2015. There was some and that doesn't really answer the question of what about the environment?
There's two
estuaries that the way that this ground is on Pineland Flatwoods Preserve, it's high up on the ground, and so then it would go down, you know, theoretically go down gradient into these estuaries. So if there's this high arsenic level, yeah, and then they also determined that she said that they closed the wells because they determined it was not coming from the wastewater treatment plant water, which is fine, but that still doesn't answer the question of, don't you want to know where it comes from? Don't you want to know
like Janine was saying.
And so I think I had that same kind of similar situation, and it's difficult to get people on the phone or do an interview and get direct answers.
Yeah, because when you're writing, you can leave out a lot, and mm-hmm. you can just answer what you want to answer in that way. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank our guests, News Press reporters Patricia Bournes and Janine Zeitlin and WGCU's Jessica Mazaros. Thank you all for joining the show today and to discuss these important stories and talk about the work that you all have done. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Coming up, we're going to talk with a Naples Daily News reporter about plans to try to improve water quality in Naples Bay. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Decades of development in the Naples Bay watershed has severely degraded the water quality, hydrology, and aquatic life in the bay. Development of the region mostly began following the construction of the Tamiami Trail in 1926, and the bay was first dredged in 1930. That was followed by more intensive dredge and fill developments in the 50s and the 60s as the population continued to grow. All of this work resulted in extensive destruction of mangroves, seagrasses, and oyster habitats within the bay. Now, it appears $1 million project that's been on the books for years to reduce pollution in Naples Bay is on track to get started early next year. We're joined for the rest of the hour by Naples Daily News reporter Eric Statz, who's covering this story. Eric, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, Julie. How are you?
It's a journalism hour, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's great. Fantastic work by my friends Janine, Patricia, and Jessica.
That's great. You can become part of this conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Eric, when did you first start covering this particular issue?
Well, let me start by saying that I cannot claim that I discovered the fact that Naples Bay was polluted. You know, that is, as you mentioned in your intro, that's been known for decades. I've been covering it ever since I got to Naples, which was 20 years ago.
So could you characterize the current state of Naples Bay for our listeners who don't get down there?
Well, if you looked at Naples Bay, you would not say this is a toxic, polluted body of water. I mean, for somebody who doesn't get on the water a lot, it's beautiful. But if you look below the surface, it's impaired is the term of art that's used for copper and iron contamination, which are toxic to marine organisms. The sediment in the bay is just muddy muck instead of the nice sandy bottom that it used to be, thanks to runoff and silt and things like that being dumped into the bay along with all the runoff that's been draining into it for forever. The big problem with Naples Bay and the fix that has eluded officials for so many years is a connection between the Golden Gate Canal system in Naples, which drains about 110 square miles of Collier County, compared to the 9 square miles that Naples Bay used to drain in Naples proper. Mm-hmm. So that expansive watershed and all of that fresh water –
is all dumping right in there.
Is dumping into the bay. And fresh water alone, regardless of what's in it, just the fact that it's fresh water being dumped into a sensitive estuarine system that needs a very delicate balance of salt water and fresh water is enough to really cause some serious problems in the bay.
So that's one of the biggest causes. What's putting the – you said copper and what was the other?
Copper and iron.
What's that? Is that from runoff?
Well yeah, the copper, I think most people blame the copper contamination on the use of copper sulfate, which is an algicide that the Naples City Council in 2008 tried to ban the use of that algicide. People use it in golf courses and stormwater lakes and such. The Department of Agriculture found out about it and wrote them kind of a polite letter saying you can't do that. Rescind your prohibition on the use of copper sulfate, which the city did.
Well, those golf courses don't just happen. You know, we just don't normally have that little, you know, really nice fine soft grass that's very difficult to make happen in our climate.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is there an alternative to that type of an algicide?
If there is, it's not one that people think works as well as copper sulfate, because that's, as far as I know, that's still sort of the go-to easiest way to deal with algae blooms on your lakes.
So then what is the cleanup plan?
Well, the $1 million cleanup plan you mentioned is the city's stormwater director admits that it's a drop in the bucket compared to the bigger problems with the Golden Gate Canal and that whole problem. But this $1 million project is something that will take one of the outfalls in the closer into the city of Naples, dredge a lot of toxic sediment that has created a shoal in the bay, get rid of that and replace it with a living shoreline, so to speak, one that they'll plant cord grasses and marsh grasses and build oyster reefs to kind of help take up nutrients that come into the bay.
It's kind of like what they did in Estero Bay.
Yeah.
But they did that years and years ago with the oyster beds and things. And
right.
That worked pretty well.
Yeah, and they've been building a lot of oyster beds in Naples Bay over the years.
And those are little cleaning powerhouses. They just filter everything.
They are. And it gets the other advantage to them is that it gets people involved in the bay. You know, you need the volunteers standing waist deep in Naples Bay handing these these bags of oysters down the row. And it gives people a sense of investment in the health of the bay.
Yeah, and I can see people maybe turn out for something like that, you know, because if there's one thing that people in Naples tend to care about, it is their environment, I've learned, or at least a good handful of people. So tell me a little bit about this sediment. Is some of that created by maybe some of the fertilizers and things that come in with the runoff that may create some little algae and stuff that can contribute to this sediment?
Well, the sediment is basically just it's just dirt, basically.
Yeah.
Dirt, sand.
But it's slimy
washes
dirt.
Well, it becomes slimy dirt once it gets into the bay.
Yeah.
And it's something that builds up over many years. Part of this $1 million project also will install a device on the collection system that will allow the water to sort of spin out and get rid of some of the sediment before it's allowed to continue on down into the outfall. So that should keep that. So we're not just digging out contaminated grit.
Uh-huh.
We're trying to keep, and I say we, the city of Naples is trying to keep it from getting there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So in your story, you quote Greg Strakalaus, and he's the Streets and Stormwater Director for the City of Naples, is saying that the project's water quality benefits will be a drop in the bucket compared to the much larger problem of discharges into Naples Bay from that vast canal system that drains land as far away as Golden Gate Estates, which you mentioned earlier. Can you tell me a little bit more about the broader issue for those that aren't really familiar with how much of an impact something like this can have?
Well, sure. Back in this goes back to the 60s, sort of getting back to my point about the problems being known for many years. When they were building Golden Gate Estates, they needed to drain a lot of land and they needed to drain it fast, so they just started building canals and they needed a place to put the water. And much of it, not all of it, but much of it comes into something that's called the Gordon River Extension, which leads to the Gordon River, which empties into Naples Bay.
Mm-hmm.
There is a plan in the works to try to divert a lot of that water south, create a new connection to a different system of drainage canals that would bring the water into it's called Henderson Creek down towards Marco Island and empty it into Rookery Bay,
mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, happens to have been cut off from its natural flow of water, so is in need of more fresh water.
Oh, okay. So I was just wondering. I'm looking at this like, well, aren't we kind of kicking the can down the road south? But it is in need of fresh water.
Right. But the trick, of course, is how – you know, what is that amount? You know, how much are people going to want to take from Naples Bay and put in Rookery Bay, and is it going to be too much for that ecosystem to handle? So there's a lot of science that goes into these things. A lot of intergovernmental coordination, a lot of money.
You get a lot of districts involved here, right?
The South Florida Water Management District is involved. The Collier County is involved. Rookery Bay is involved. Mm-hmm. The city of Naples, of course. The thing that has sort of gotten this project sort of off the dime is some funding that has been requested in connection with the Restore Act, which is the act that set up the BP – Deepwater Horizon oil spill settlement funds. And the county is hoping to get a chunk of that money to be able to start work at least on the first phase of that project.
Oh, okay. So it's coming from that. So do they think they're actually going to be able to fix the problem with these various projects? I mean, is that something
– Well, the optimistic natural resources managers that I talk to say it's absolutely a fixable problem.
Okay.
It's not a problem that's going to be fixed with one project. It's a project.
It sounds like multi-pronged for sure.
Right, right. And sort of a, you know, both of us a concerted effort not only to restore but to do some things to keep the bay from continuing to degrade. The city has passed fertilizer laws, for example. The South Florida Water Management District has replaced a series of weirs along the Golden Gate Canal that allows them to more carefully control how much water they release into the bay. The district also did a project a few years back to actually take water out of the canal, send it to the city's wastewater treatment plant, and then use it for irrigation.
Oh, yeah. It's not a bad idea.
So there's lots of ways to tackle the problem, and we'll just have to wait and see how much it helps.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guest, Eric Statz, reporter for Naples Daily News. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone, Mike Canaire, and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.